Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven back with us. Scott, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Talk with him about, the effects of cold weather on wildlife. We can talk about the turkey season and, of course, take your questions as well. Or maybe share an experience. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Scott, good to have you back and good to have you in the studio for the first time in a couple of years.
Well, it's always great to be on the program, Larry, but it's particularly pleasant to be back here in the studio after a very long absence. And I don't know, getting back into society and normal activities is a wonderful thing.
Tell you what, the turkey season, of course, is on today. We're into the third period now. And there's been a little rumbling around the state a bit about not seeing as many turkeys.
Well, that certainly is true for me. I had a permit for the first period back at the end of April, and I saw and heard very few birds. But, of course, it's been a bizarre spring, so it's always tricky to tease out exactly what's going on at any one time. And turkeys, like any other animal, are not uniformly distributed around the landscape. So I didn't pay a great deal of attention to that. But then in talking to fellow hunters over a fair swath of southern Wisconsin and some other places in the state, I began to hear more and more of the same reports and then started to dig a little bit. And lo and behold, there was an article out from a fellow from the National Wild Turkey Federation talking about turkey declines across the country. There was an account that came out yesterday from a writer in Pennsylvania about how hard it's been to find turkeys in Pennsylvania. Same thing for Kansas, Missouri. Mm. And it seems like a nationwide phenomenon, at least where the eastern wild turkey range is, which is about the eastern two-thirds of the country. So the question then, of course, is what the heck is going on? Because, you know, the turkey population exploded after the reintroduction, and it's normal for some populations in new or virgin habitat to kind of overshoot the mark a little bit
and then
readjust a bit. But, you know, I'm talking about areas, for example, one of the farms that I hunt in Iowa County that, you could always drive out there in the countryside early in the morning and in the evening, and, geez, it seemed like there'd be turkeys in every field, especially in the winter when they're very visible. And that hasn't been the case. So the bottom line is there does seem to be something going on over a broad swath of the country, and people are beginning to try and tease out what might be happening, whether it's predators or habitat. I don't know.
We don't know yet.
But it's an interesting thing to think about, and it would be most unfortunate if it is reality or becomes reality, because the turkey season has become a very popular thing in the spring, and just seeing turkeys has become very popular for everybody that's driving around rural Wisconsin. And today, as you said, marks the first day of the third of 6 week-long hunting periods. So we're reaching the halfway point, and I guess if listeners have any observations that the turkeys are breaking down their fences and storming the house, or, gee, I haven't seen a turkey for the last 2 months, then that'd be a good thing to share with us, and we'll see if we're on the mark with this.
Jeff in Grand Marsh has, it's not about turkeys, I think it's about black bears. Let's go to Jeff. Jeff, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning, guys. I have a black bear on my house camera Monday night. The wife said he got onto the bird feeder, and I'm just curious, what is their range?
So you're in Grand Marsh, Jeff.
Correct.
What county?
Adams.
Well, Adams. I mean, that's certainly within range, and bears have been expanding their range south, and they're very mobile as well. So I wouldn't out of hand rule out somebody seeing a bear in any county in Wisconsin. And, you know, they are out and about now, a little slower up in the Northwoods where the ice and snow are just disappearing finally. But that's no surprise, and it's no surprise that he's out. and that he's hungry after a long winter's sleep, and that he's after your bird feeder. So it would be prudent to take that bird feeder down for a while and let the bear move off to forage for something else.
Yeah, probably not a bad idea at all. I can remember my mom and dad in their cabin in northern Wisconsin every spring that day, get those bird feeders down, because there'd be a couple, two or three black bears that would wind up over there over time.
Squirrels and things like that are hard on feeders, but a 300-pound bear with good yeah. jaw strength is really tough on a feeder. So take them down.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You talked about the potential that there may be fewer turkeys around, but there are lots of birds around.
Well,
this is a great time of the year.
It's a great time of year. And, the first, if I think back, I think my red wing, the ones that I see around the yard, people get possessive of what they see mm-hmm. on their own feeders. But in any event, the blackbirds returned, I think it was March 5th, and then the robins were here and assorted other early migrants. 4 days ago, I think the rose-breasted grosbeak showed up in force. And yesterday, I had an unusual bird at the feeder. I had a scarlet tanager, male,
nice.
Just spectacular bird.
Yeah.
And he showed up, mid-morning, I guess, and my wife said, "Hey, what's that bird?" And I said, "Oh, it's a scarlet tanager." And the little guy stayed around all day. And he looked, it was not another pleasant day yesterday. And he was kind of looking around like, "Oh, I think I've made a mistake again." And then he disappeared late last evening. So hopefully he's doing okay. But I'm waiting for the orioles. I had a neighbor report, yep, he had his jelly feeder out. And not only did he have northern orioles, or I still call them Baltimore orioles, but he had an orchard oriole too. So they're back in some places. So if there are any cool bird sightings to report, let us know.
Yeah, normally it's around between the May 4th and 6th that I see my first Baltimore Oriole.
Well, I'm guessing you'll probably see one tomorrow, because it's supposed to be pretty nice today. And they're talking about maybe even some 80s next week. So what I'm afraid is that we got shortchanged on spring. And it's kind of going to go from late winter to summer over a span of about a week's time. But it's just been very slow coming. And I have some empathy for our frog populations. You know, in the backyard where I have a little pond and I built an artificial frog bog last year, I started to hear the toads and chorus frogs 4 or 5 weeks ago. And they kind of a half-hearted chirp or croak for a little while, and then they were gone for a week, and then another chirp or trill from the toads and gone again. And then last week they got cranked up for a couple of days, and now they've been silent again. And I had a pair of breeding toads in the pond 3 or 4 days ago, just floating there in the process of creating a new generation of toads, but they sure didn't look very happy with the water temperature or the air temperature. So we'll see what happens.
And it's kind of fouled up the gardening too. I mean, certainly there's obviously no gardening going on in the northern part of the state yet. But here in the south, normally a person gets out there and is able to do a little bit of planting in April.
Well, I tried desperately to get early things like radishes and peas in, but the soil was in such poor shape that was almost impossible. So I think it'll really be next week probably before things get underway. And that's true, of course, with commercial agriculture too. Nobody's been able to work in the fields. And what I see on the farm reports suggests that we're at least 2 weeks behind, if not more, on planting dates for corn and soybeans and whatnot. So, we need some nice weather.
Let's talk about Conservation Congress. You know, there have been the meetings, of course, were done. And do you have any updates on the results?
Well, for people unfamiliar with it, the Conservation Congress is a citizen input opportunity. Anybody, it's always been somewhat contentious, this is dominated by hunters. But the reality is anyone on any side of the conservation fence, but with an interest in the outdoors and conservation, can participate in the Congress hearings and make their voice known. And there's a way to offer resolutions and then vote on the resolutions that have been put forth by the Congress or the DNR board or the DNR itself. And there's sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 questions that public can have input on. Things like back when we had the question about should we hunt mourning doves, that was one of the big ones. And then there was a contentious one about cats and so on. So anyway, the voting opportunity this year was virtual again and held from April 11th to the 14th. And I think if my numbers are correct, there were some just south of 30,000 people participated and voted, somewhere around 28,000. Most of whom were residents, but again, what their leanings were was reflected more in the votes than in the numbers. So anyway, the opportunity took place again, and there were a few interesting things. There was a lot of interest in what people were going to say about the wolf population and whether there should be a numerical sideboards on it, as opposed to, I think the recommendation from the DNR board president is to not put a number on the wolf population and therefore avoid, oh, there's too many or there's too few or whatever. But actually, there was pretty substantial support favoring the population goal, which has been in place since the management plan that's been expired for a long time. That was 350 animals. And that was, in fact, supported by the vote at the Congress hearing. So I think by about a 66%.
Oh, it's pretty,
margin.
Pretty
so
big
it was,
margin.
It was pretty substantial. Now, whether that will show up in final rules or the final management plan, which is a work in progress and so on, who knows? But that was what the public had to say. There were also some interesting votes. There was considerable support, which sort of surprised me, although I guess in a way I'm kind of hopeful that we might backtrack on some of the things we lost during the deer season back with the so-called Deer Czar report in 2012. For example, the in-person registration option, the use of tags, back tags. Some of those things like in-person registration and returning to back tags received substantial support. So, again, whether we'll go back to that kind of – it's always hard to go back. But
I didn't throw away my little plastic liner for back tags.
I still have it in my pile of deer hunting stuff. So we'll see what happens with that kind of thing. But I know there's been concern over compliance with telephone registration and things like that. Granted, it's certainly easier and convenient and so forth. But, you know, you wonder when it just makes you wonder a little bit.
Yeah.
And the way things seem to be going in society, the whole thing kind of makes me wonder a lot more. But anyway, so the Conservation Congress hearing for 2022 is in the books, and there's an interesting column in Outdoor News. If you get that or want to look on it online, it summarizes all the voting, and you can also go to the DNR website and click on Congress and see what the voting was for a whole host of things. Some of the resolutions are very localized, like you know, should the bass limit be increased by 3 millimeters on Lake Jones or something?
Yeah.
Geez, I don't know.
But
many of them, like the wolves and some of the ones in the past, like the dove hunt resolution, receive a lot of attention.
Jim in Loganville will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
What's on your mind today?
Oh, I got about a dozen yellow-rumped warblers that have been hanging around my feeders for a week, and I've never seen them here before.
Well, it's a good find, especially when you see a number of them. They're pretty little bird. They used to be called myrtle warblers, I think, but anyway, the names changed to protect the innocent. But they're pretty little things, and they're coming and going like many birds right now. So enjoy what you have while you have them, because you may not have them for very long. It's kind of for a lot of those species that are headed further north or breaking up and spreading out to nest, it's a here today, gone tomorrow situation.
Yeah.
And the big celebration, of course, I think a week from, let's see, fishing opener is Saturday the 7th.
Right.
A week later, the 14th, is International Migratory Bird Day. And there'll be lots of attention given to birds in the press and so forth in association with Migratory Bird Day. And just something that marks the time on this calendar.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call and the report. Thank you very much. Scott Craven, our guest today. Jill Nador, producer Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of wildlife on the show today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in. And if you have questions or maybe a wildlife an experience you want to share, you can join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. There a couple of other things. You mentioned one migratory bird day on my birthday, actually, this year, May 14th.
Well, happy birthday, Larry, in advance. That's
yeah, it's kind of cool to have it on my birthday. But we got you mentioned the fishing season opener, of course, is May 7th.
Yes. What else did I have on the hit list here for important dates? Migratory bird day, the fishing opener. We talked about the turkey periods and number three starting today. One thing for the people who are interested in applying for kind of that once-in-a-lifetime elk hunting opportunity in Wisconsin, The elk applications are due, I think, by the end of this month. So if you're interested in that, get on the DNR website and find out what you need to do. And I guess the last thing I wanted to mention, this is DNR Lyme Disease Awareness Month. So watch out for those deer ticks. Their theme for Lyme Disease Awareness Month is Fight the Bite. So there's lots of information on the DNR website. But, hey, Lyme disease is a serious thing. And for those of us who are outdoors chasing turkeys or doing any number of other things, those darn ticks are kind of a nuisance. Yeah. And there's a whole series. I looked at the website, and there's a whole series of guidelines about repellents and how you wear your clothes and tick checks and all that kind of thing. So be careful out there.
And I did want to mention one of my own meetings coming up on May 7th, where we have a WPR listener appreciation morning at the Retzer Nature Center in Waukesha area there. It's a free event to say thanks to WPR fans in southeast Wisconsin. And so you can stop by between 10 a.m. and noon, and we'll have some coffee and donuts, a conversation with, I'll be there. And Sheila Shigley will be there from Simply Folk. I know Trina LaSousa, our engineer, who's on the air once in a while, too, will be there. And, of course, you can pick up some WPR swag and check out some fun activities. We'll have some games. We have an art project. It's a s'mores station. I'll be there. I'll park right there. We'll do some. There's a hike. It's a great hiking. Retzer Nature Center is a great place.
It's a great place, and I know they used to have. I don't know if they still do, but they used to have a big native plant sale in the spring, and timing would be about right with the late spring. So maybe if you go see Larry and have some s'mores, you can pick up some native plants too.
Never know. That's May 7th, this Saturday from 10 to noon.
One other thing, if I might, since you mentioned that event, I want to thank you. This is the first time I've been on for a while in person, but thank you again for allowing me to help put in a good word for some of the tours we lead during the winter. And Yellowstone in winter was canceled last winter, but we'll go again this coming year. But we did do the Everglades tour, and holy cow, that was fantastic.
And a lot of WPR listeners.
Virtually everybody on the tour had heard about it while we were talking about it on WPR, signed up almost immediately, and it was a fantastic group of people. So, hey, if you're listening out there, thanks for going. That was a great week in the Everglades.
And we have some people calling here, so let's take a call. But first, let me give you the number to call. If you haven't called yet and want to, it's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And Scott, there's lots more we can talk about for sure. The fundraising activities, that's one thing I wondered about. The pandemic stopped a lot of those
fundraising activities for conservationists?
It did, but they're coming back online. Last Thursday night, I was lucky enough to MC the banquet for the Dane County Conservation League.
Oh, and great.
And that's always been a popular local banquet here.
Yeah.
But I wanted to put for folks unaware of these things, virtually all of the big conservation-related groups, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Dane County Conservation League, Rough Grouse Society, and there are dozens of them. And among those, they all have dozens of chapters around Wisconsin, and every chapter has a fundraising banquet. And the nice thing about that is that the bulk of the funds go back into conservation related to that particular group's mission.
Yeah.
So it may be to provide new habitat for ducks. It may be to raise some pheasants in the case of the Dane County Conservation League, or a whole host of other things. Plus, they're fun.
Yeah.
And it's usually a good meal. They're based on raffles and all sorts of games and things to liberate you from your money. But again, the money's going to a good cause, and you know, a high percentage of people walk away from the banquet with a new igloo cooler or a shotgun or something, and everybody's smiling and happy and has a great time. So if you've never thought about one of those, it's a fun thing to do when you hear about them.
I want a whole shotgun, a whole turkey setup with decoys and a shotgun and calls. At the Wild Turkey Federation meeting one year.
You are one lucky guy.
I was that night, that's for sure. Diane and Spooner, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling, Diane.
Yes. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Great. We have a couple questions. We seem to have a very busy robin at our windows lately. Business that's pretty much all day. And it just keeps banging into our windows.
Yeah.
Not a quick little flutter, but it's very persistent. And never seen that kind of activity. We live in a wooded area. We're rural. So we have many birds, but we've just never seen a robin with this kind of activity and behavior.
Well, I sympathize. It's a pain in the neck when they do that, and it's very common. I started getting emails about this about a week ago. So I've been responding to those, and for all the listeners who may be victimized, there are a few other birds that will do it, but robins are the most widespread and the most persistent. And what's going on is that a male robin has set up shop somewhere around your house in a favored shrub or whatever, and somewhere nearby his mate is nesting. And he's done what he needed to do, so now the job is protect the home front. And as he's sitting there in his favorite shrub, he looks in your window and sees his reflection and thinks, oh, no, it's Frank, the neighboring robin, in my territory. And he attacks what he thinks is another robin, but it's just his reflection in the window. And when he composes himself and goes back to the shrub and looks again, well, Frank is still there. Wham! Into the window again. And you would think they'd catch on, but they don't. And I remember accounts when I was doing this, when I was working full-time, where windows would become covered with mud and blood, and it was just awful and very annoying. So, okay, what do you do about it? Well, you can grit your teeth and wait until the nesting period is over and the young robins have fledged. And then the impetus for protecting the home is no longer, and they're gone. Most people don't like that alternative. So more immediately, you can deaden the reflection of the window. You could cover it, for example, with some rolled, wrapping paper or packing paper or something, and just do without the window. Sometimes closing the shade affects the reflection. I've seen people kind of soap the windows to deaden the reflection. The surefire approach is to get a piece of plastic bird netting, which is sold in garden centers, and drape that, or you could use anything you happen to have, even some old fishnet might work, but drape it down over the window, keeping it away from the window by a half an inch or an inch, and that will prevent the robin from getting to the window. Sometimes they'll move to another window, but if this is kind of an isolated window on a corner or side of the house, protecting that one may be all you need to do. So I've heard of some more devious people taking an inexpensive shaving mirror, like one that kind of tilts when you're putting on makeup or shaving, and just hanging that in a bush or shrub near
away
the window, away from the window, and the bird fights with his reflection in the mirror, and okay, well, no harm, no foul in that case. So anyway, the bottom line is you have to do something about preventing the bird from either getting access to his reflection or seeing his reflection, and that'll put an end to it.
Or wait.
Or wait.
There you go, Diane. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call.
I should point out one last thing just for general information, Larry, about birds like that, whether it's robins on your windows or some bird eating your cherries off the tree or whatever. Virtually all of these birds, with few exceptions, are fully protected by state and federal law. So no matter how annoying the robin is banging on your window, the approach you can't use, and you can get in a lot of trouble doing it, is to run out the front door with a shotgun and end the problem that way. That you can't do that. And so just keep that in mind.
Diane, thanks again. Louis in Ocado will go to you next. Hi, Louis.
Hello. I want to just give a shout-out to John and Nick. Hopefully they're listening. They're great listeners also. I have a comment and then a question.
Okay.
One is that 350 wolf carrying population, I believe it was Central Time that had a fantastic program. Hopefully you can find the link to it and post it on your post, Larry, but it was about the wolves in Wisconsin, and fantastic program. Can't recommend it enough, but that would be great for everyone to listen to. They had a expert guest, and I think they spent most of the hour talking about wolves in Wisconsin and how they were introduced, and I think that 350 was just at the time what they could get at the time, but my question for Scott is, do we do a grouse count in Wisconsin? And also, if you could comment on the wolves.
Well, you know, the number of wolves is contentious for a couple of reasons. Number one, there are people who don't want as many on the landscape as some other people do, so that's part of the issue. The other problem is knowing what the real number is. And the other problem is keeping the population at that number. So it's really a moving target. And we'll see what happens when the new management plan is released and which way they go with this. The notion that wolves were introduced is not really the case. I hope they didn't do that on the program you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Because wolves are a native species, and they were here. They weren't doing well for a long time. But given the intense protection and management that went into them back in the 80s and 90s, they rebounded very nicely. They never really brought wolves in or reintroduced them from anywhere else. They either got here on their own, which they're fully capable of doing, or they simply increased in place. But anyway, enough about that. As far as the grouse counts, yes, standard grouse population surveys, known as drumming counts, have been conducted for years in Wisconsin. And that's what gives us an index to the status of the population in relation to their 10-year cycle of abundance. Now, the problem is that those counts were suspended during COVID. And whether the biologists are out there again this spring or not, I don't know. I haven't heard, actually. I would think they would be, but...
Yeah, I think they are.
It's a relatively safe situation, roaming around the countryside, driving the transects and listening for drumming male grouse. And then that provides, again, an index to the population. And that's how we hear, for example, that, yeah, we're on the downward side of the population cycle, which I think we are.
We are now, yeah.
So it's dropping down, and probably in, 2, 3, 4 years, it'll reach a low point, and then all of a sudden it'll turn around entirely naturally, and they'll begin to bounce back to a population high. And it's those drumming indices that allow us to know where we are in the cycle. So, yes, I hope they're out there doing them, but they did not for a couple of years because of COVID.
Thanks, Louie. Appreciate it. Kim and Bloomer, your turn. Hi, Kim.
Good morning, Larry and Scott. I'm on my way to go turkey hunting, and my question would be, are the hens roosted up, or are they, the weather was too bad, so the toms don't have all the hens gathered up, or?
I saw so few turkeys that I can't draw many conclusions, but I think most of the people I know who are out hunting by now, we'd expect some of the hens to be on nest. And the few hens that are out there, the gobblers are still pursuing. And then, of course, what the turkey hunters are interested in, when most of the hens have gone to nest, then the gobblers are really covering some landscape looking for additional hens for breeding purposes. And that's when they tend to get a little more vulnerable. When they're in a big flock with a lot of hens, it's really hard to call them away from those hens. But I think you should be in pretty good shape right now. The ones I've seen around the house, there's still been a couple of gobblers traveling together and not really showing any sign of aggression, and they seem to have gotten really quiet. I know there are birds around my house, for example, but as I told my son last night, he's coming out to hunt this weekend. I said, trying to do things in the yard or whatever else, I've not heard a single gobble yet. I've seen the gobblers, but I have not heard a single gobble. And there's one of the theories I've read about in looking into whether the turkeys are on the downslide for whatever reason is that one of the reasons is predation, particularly by coyotes, and that coyotes, if you're hunting and see a gobbler or a bunch of hens, it's apparently not uncommon to see them being stalked by coyotes that have learned to come to the sound of the turkeys, either gobbling or clucking, putting, whatever. And the response, if a turkey survives that a couple of times, it's time to keep quiet. I don't have any idea whether that's substantiated or not, but it's an interesting theory.
It sure is.
Get out there and have fun. This is a nice day, and it's going to rain like heck again tomorrow. So get one today.
There you go, Kim. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Jill in Cross Plains, your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, I'm going to shift gears a bit here, and I'm wondering, Scott, if you have found any morels in the woods yet. We're in southern Wisconsin, and we have not found a single one yet.
This has been such a crummy spring. That's what I'm getting from my pals, too, that get out morel hunt.
Yeah, I have not seen a one. And I've not seen much else in the world of fungus either. But in rooting around the last couple of days trying to get a few new perennials in the ground is mighty cold. Yeah. So I think this will all change next week when they're talking about maybe some temperatures close to 80 degrees. And now with good moisture, because the drought's got a dent in it as well, I think we're maybe a week away. And I have a couple of people that always send me very proudly a nice picture of their first morel of the season, and I've not heard zip from those folks. So I don't think anything's happening yet.
Yeah, I have a spot that I go to that I have been fortunate, shall we say, in years past to find morels, and I know right where to go. And I haven't even gone yet because the weather's been so crappy and cold. It just hasn't been worth it.
You're going to be busy with some commitments. You could mark that on my Onyx maps, drop a pin, and I'll check them out for you.
Maybe next year.
Yeah, maybe next year.
Jill, thanks a lot for calling. Next week, that'll be the time, probably, hopefully.
Well, remember, the oak leaves have to be the size of a mouse's ear.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that.
The oak leaves haven't even broken bud yet. Yeah. I usually watch my lilacs, too, and they're a ways from blooming. So maybe even next week might be optimistic.
Yeah, middle of the month. Yeah. Middle of the month. There you go, Joe. Thanks a lot. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn.
Hi. I'm just calling in relationship to the birds hitting the windows. And when they see their reflection, some birds can actually become exhausted when they do that because they won't stop. And so probably the more humane thing is, like you were saying, to cover the windows and because it could harm them.
Yeah, rather than the mirror. Yeah, that makes some sense.
There are also, I didn't mention that some of the bird-related stores and places that deal with outdoor stuff often sell, and of course you can get them online, black silhouettes of hawks and other things that some people have reasonable luck putting on the inside of the window, and that also deters the birds. So that's something else you can try. I've also heard of trying owl decoys, of trying various balloons hanging from the window that blow in the slightest breeze. Anything you can do to distract the bird from his reflection is, in the long range, long term, really good for you and really good for the bird.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat, thank you very much. Let's go to Mary in Madison next. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hello, just a moment.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. I'm about four blocks from Park Street, and I'm bounded by Olin Avenue, about a block away from Olin Avenue where I live, and then Lakeside, another block.
Yeah.
So, but once in a while, I'll find, looking out my window, not often, turkeys.
Uh-huh.
Well, turkeys.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if someone's interested in that, making a study of that, or
there you're in my neighborhood, Mary. I'm on Summers Avenue, my home is, so I'm pretty close to where you are, and we see turkeys fairly regularly in the neighborhood.
The reality, Mary, is that urban turkeys are rather common, and in years past, we used to get complaints that they'd be approaching people's windows, chasing male persons, doing all sorts of things like that. And generally, they are kind of oblivious to people and traffic and whatnot, and just go about their business. So I don't have any idea how many turkeys call Madison home, but I know there's quite
a lot of them, quite a
population in the Arboretum, and I'm sure they don't stay in the Arboretum 24/7. So enjoy seeing them. They're kind of neat. They're big bird, and if you see a gobbler this time of year, all fanned out and displaying and gobbling and drumming and whatnot, it's about the most spectacular thing you can see in the bird world. So enjoy it, and they'll take care of themselves. They're very resourceful.
Mary, thank you very much for calling. Yeah, that's our neighborhood, and we'll see turkeys. Mike in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello there. I thought it might be worth mentioning that if you haven't heard, a nesting eagle in the city of Milwaukee about a week ago or two succumbed to bird flu. And it occurred to me, I wonder if wild turkeys are very susceptible to that.
Well, there have been problems reported in, particularly in raptors like eagles, and also in waterfowl, but not so much in
turkeys.
In fact, there's been a great deal of anxiety over, boy, what's going to happen with our pheasant farms, like the state pheasant farm in Poinette. That's at its highest level of biocontainment security right now, and I suspect private pheasant farms are as well. And there was a lot of concern over the turkey population. Of course, we're right in the middle of the season, as we mentioned. However, the lead article in Outdoor News yesterday was interviewed several experts that said they did not think that avian influenza was a threat to turkeys, pheasants, or ruff grouse, which for people in the bird hunting community, that's very good news.
Sigh of relief.
So
yeah.
I don't think that's anything we need to worry about.
But thank you very much for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest today, as we talk the world of wildlife. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Questions? Email at ideas@wpr.org, or you can phone us at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Graham emailed to let us know about a live stream webcam at Goose Pond Sanctuary. It has great Zoom and HD video. They've seen mammals, amphibians, at least 40 species of birds since installing it. And on Monday, while conducting a waterfowl pair count,
They found 95 pairs of mallards, a western meadowlark, a blue-gray gnatcatcher, and 46 other bird species. And if you want to go to that video, just go. You can Google Goose Pond Webcam Madison Audubon. Goose Pond Webcam Madison Audubon. That'll be fun. I got to take a look at that after the show.
There are a lot of them, Larry. If you look around a little bit on the internet, there are lots of osprey and eagle cams right now on nests with young, and lots of active feeder webcams as well. So if you can't see your feeder from the dining room table, you can call it up on your computer monitor and watch somebody else's feeder and see what's going on.
Yeah, Gene, speaking of that, Gene in Rice Lake emailed people talking about their feeders. She thought we were supposed to bring in our feeders due to bird flu, and she'd love to put her feeders up if it's safe to do it.
I think it probably is, especially if you're off the beaten path a bit.
Yeah. Richard in Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Scott. I was wondering what you knew about Isle Royal. It seemed like 10 or 12 years ago, the wolf population was almost wiped out. Somebody supposedly took a dog over there and spread a virus. And then, of course, with the wolves almost being gone, it allows the moose to, their population to increase. So I wonder what you knew about what's going on up there.
Well, not a great deal that's up to date. A lot of things were suspended out there during COVID. Prior to that, there had been a couple reintroductions from the mainland that the Park Service had brought some wolves over to try and augment the population. Some stayed, some didn't. It's a big deal up at Isle Royal, whether there's an ice bridge in any given year. Some years there's contiguous ice between Isle Royal and the Minnesota shore, and wolves can kind of come and go on their own. I think some came, some left. Where they are right now with numbers, I think they're just gearing up back out there the way everybody else is after COVID. And I've not seen very much from Rolf Peterson or the people on the research team or from the Park Service. So I can't give you a definitive answer to that. That Isle Royal is one of the sites of these that we use for these tour groups that I'm involved with. I haven't been out there for, I think, 5 or 6 years now. But you're right. The wolves were down to one or two individuals, and they weren't very thrifty,
old,
so to speak. And there was, of course, concern that there was going to be a boom in the moose population, which would have destroyed the habitat and ultimately the moose. And the Park Service was conducting surveys on what the public thought they should do. But where they stand right now, I don't know. But I'm guessing if you Google Park Service and see what you can find on Isle Royal, they'll update you that way.
Yeah. Richard, thanks. Karen in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I kind of just heard the answer, but I'm going to ask anyway because I'd like a little bit more information. So I also have been hearing that we're supposed to stop feeding our birds because of the bird flu. I live a little south of Eau Claire out in the country, and I also have chickens. So I kind of I don't want to lose my chickens.
Yeah.
What if you said if you're off the beaten path, but what does that really mean?
Well, I think if you've got backyard chickens, I think that's an extra risk factor that if I were in that situation, I'd be keeping the chickens under control rather than having them roam around in the backyard kind of thing. Get them penned up. And I'd be careful with my feeders. My feeders, I don't know how many I've got around the house now, but I don't have any chickens, and the feeders are active and birds are going through, and things seem to be okay. There have been diminishing reports of poultry flocks being depopulated because of flu, and whether that means as the migration slows down here and a lot of the waterfowl's already gone through, I think we're coming out of it. But in terms of a solid recommendation, I can't give you one. But if I had chickens, I'd be more careful than the average person.
Yeah. There you go, Karen. Thank you. Phil in Lake Geneva, we're on to you now. Hi, Phil.
Hey, you guys, I'm just south of Lake Geneva, and I've got to ask Scott a question here. First of all, I saw one gobbler with six hens, and he fully fanned. So we went down the road about a quarter of a mile. We're doing some work. And my question is, I saw two groups of jakes with about 6 to 7 inch beards, one nine birds, one eight birds, and the ground is covered with coyote tracks, just for information there. I wanted to know what you think the age of those jakes are.
6 inches
well,
is
that's,
pretty long.
I mean, 6 inches is a pretty long beard for a jake. I mean, that might be a, you know, a jake basically is last year's hatched gobbler, and the beards are most often like kind of a stubby
little shaving brush, maybe
3 or 4 inches at the most. You start to get up to 6 inches where the beard is really noticeable. I think you've got a young gobbler, you know, maybe a 2 or 3 year old bird on your hands rather than jakes. If there were others in the flock that had the shorter beards, there could be both mixed. I've had a few marching through the backyard where there's one jake with a beard I can barely see, and a couple of really long beards with their beards dragging in the grass. But usually there's a distinctive difference. As far as the coyote tracks around, I'm not sure what the relationship is there, but those turkeys better be on their toes.
Absolutely. Phil, thank you. Dennis in Athens, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. Hey, great show, by the way. All your shows are great. I do have a question. On our farm, there's a well-ensconced family of swallows ever since I was a child. I was coming home one day, and I noticed 20 or 30 feet from the driveway a cluster of swallows, and I slowed down, of course. I didn't want to hurt anything. As I got closer, I noticed a single swallow was dead, apparently hit by a car or something. But what was odd was there were 3 or 4 swallows around it, and there around them were 2 or 3 other little groupings of 3 or 4. And it was, to me, it was apparently awake. They were chattering amongst each other. The groups in the outside would come into the center group, and they would exchange places. Swallows would come in, swallows would leave. But it just screamed of a swallow wake.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Dennis, I'm not sure what to say about that. You know, as humans, when we see different types of animal behavior, you know, two animals coming together and apparently greeting themselves, or any forms of animal behavior that somehow can be related either in reality or in our minds to human behavior, I think that's just a tendency that we tend to go toward. Certainly there are some indications that, you know, when a parent animal is lost, a female mallard, for example, and the ducklings are scrambling around, you know, hey, what's going on here, on their own, or a fawn that's traveling with a doe and the doe is shot or hit by a car or something, you know, they'll hang around or approach the downed animal kind of thing. And that, you know, we read a little more into that than we could or should, but I don't know what to say about the swallows. I mean, there are a bunch of swallows aggregated on the side of a driveway, dead one or not. You know, there are other explanations in terms of, for example, hey, had it just rained, was there a mud puddle there? Because swallows will come and go in a very vigorous sense to grab mud pellets that they use for their nests. And, you know, you get the impression that they're maybe doing something that they aren't. So anyway, there may be other explanations for what you were seeing, Dennis, but if that's about all I can say.
Yeah. Dennis, thank you very much for calling. Skip in Milton, we'll go to you. Hi, Skip. Skip, are you there? Maybe we lost Skip. We'll put Skip on hold. Let's go to Al in Green Bay. Hi, Al.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I literally have an appointment in my iPhone for the days that Scott's going to be on.
Well, thank you. I should do that, too.
You're probably not going to be enamored with a question, Scott, but what's the current state of research in terms of COVID affecting deer? I'm talking about white-tailed deer in Wisconsin. What's the current state of research about should we be eating our venison this coming fall?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, everybody's trying to put COVID behind us, first and foremost. And while there were, I remember seeing a couple articles that COVID had been identified in a deer, but it didn't seem to go anywhere. That seemed to be a dead end. And I've not seen or heard anything lately. And given the variety of issues with deer consumption because of chronic wasting disease and other such things, I think COVID is a remote concern and not something that, as a deer hunter, is not something that's on my radar screen for this fall.
As opposed to
CWD, which has caused me great personal grief. But anyway, I don't think that's something you need to worry about, Al. And if it is, as deer season approaches, rest assured there'll be plenty of publicity.
Thanks for calling. Scott Craven, our guest. We are going to take a break and take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. You can still join in. He'll be with us right up till 12:30 at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Got a couple of cool photos we'll talk about next after our news break as well. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Emeritus Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Great to have him back and great to have you listening in. Give a call with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Scott, we had Jamie sent us a photo of a naked-tailed squirrel. So it looks almost like a rat tail. You saw it.
Yep.
Wondering what would cause the fur to come off the tail.
Well, there's really only two choices. Either mechanical injury, you know, it got its tail caught in something, or, you know, run over and crushed as it was avoiding a car and the hair fell out, whatever. Or some disease issue, you know, some type of mange or something like that. I simply don't know.
Yeah, the rest of the animal looks fine.
Yeah, it looks okay. It's just a naked tail, so it's possible that there was some type of injury there, and from the point of injury, the tail just basically died, so to speak, and there's not much left there but the tail vertebrae.
Skip in Milton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Skip.
Yes, can you hear me?
We can.
Yeah, go ahead.
I am calling about the wolf situation, and I probably missed some of it before. I just tuned in late. But there are usually well over a million deer, maybe a million and a half or up to 1.7 million deer in Wisconsin, and maybe 1,000 wolves. And, it, you know, the need for a wolf hunt just doesn't click with me. I know in some areas the wolves do decimate the deer herd, but overall there's plenty of deer.
Yeah. So, and there is some, I think 1,000's pretty steep on the number of wolves in the state, but.
You know, the wolf numbers will peak out here in an annual peak very quickly,
yeah,
with the pups and all, and may even exceed 1,000. But it's still a relatively small number compared to the deer herd. I understand that, but the wolves and the deer aren't necessarily in the same places either. Where wolves are common in the northern third, relatively common in the northern third of the state, that's where our deer herd is the thinnest at this point, and where deer are very abundant in the central farmland and southern counties. No or very few wolves. So they don't necessarily overlap. The concern for at some point having a hunt, the hunt thing got pretty complicated because of the fiasco a year ago February with the hunt that was essentially forced by a judicial decision due to a lawsuit from a hunter group in Kansas. Don't get me started on them. But nevertheless, it happened. It was a last-minute rush thing, and people got anxious about the large number of wolves that were taken. That's all a moot point right now because wolves have been put back on the endangered species list. They're like a ping pong ball, on, off, on, off, on, off. They're currently on, so there will be no hunt. So we're back to dealing with abatement techniques for people having problems with wolves with livestock or whatever. We're back to the techniques that were available before they were put back on the endangered species list. So right now it probably doesn't matter. So hopefully in this downtime while they're back on the list, the wolf plan, which has been long in the making, will be completed and released, and we'll know whether we're dealing with a numerical population goal or some sort of a threshold population. And the plans will be laid so that if and when wolves come off the list again, if a hunt is deemed necessary to keep them somewhere near the numerical goal as it's formulated, then they'll have time to do that as efficiently as they did back in, I think, 2012, 13, 14, in that range, when they did hold a hunt. It was very well managed. The harvest was within a wolf or two of the quota every year, and it ran very smoothly, unlike the fiasco February ago. So, you know, we'll see. Right now it doesn't matter. They're an endangered species, and we have to do what we can to prevent wolf problems, and we'll see what happens when they become unprotected again.
Yeah, thank you, Skip. Appreciate it. Jane emailed in that the Madison Audubon advises that you do take down your bird feeders and baths if your feeders are visited by birds like waterfowl, raptors, or other species that are highly susceptible to the influenza, and you keep domestic poultry or live in close proximity to a poultry farm.
Well, there you go. We stumbled on the right answer, Larry, even though we really didn't know. So
there you go. Okay. And Jane, thanks for emailing that into us. Let's go to Tim in Kenosha next. Tim, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I was disappointed this year. I live in Kenosha, just a mile or so from the Kenosha Harbor. And I had a kid that used to mow my lawn, wanted me to teach him how to catch the Chinook salmon down there in the harbor, where they usually come in. Well, I haven't fished in about 7 years, but I was really disappointed to see that the mouth of Pikes Creek was closed off because of some storms that we had had. And normally, I don't know if it was the DNR or the city, they'd have a bulldozer down there and open the creek up. But I talked to a charter captain that I know, and he said that the DNR said that they was going to go all natural. And I don't know. The charter captain asked the DNR, well, what about if we went and dug it out? And the DNR told him that he'd give him a ticket. And it just doesn't seem right, you know, for them salmon to come in and want to come up Pikes Creek where they was spawned before, and them not be able to get up there.
Well, I guess I agree with you, Tim, in the sense that something doesn't seem quite right.
Yeah.
Ordinarily, if there was a blockage of a navigable stream or a stream important for fish movement or whatever that was blocked by storm debris, that it would just be a matter of course and common sense to just clean it out. But I'm not familiar with the creek or the setting or who's calling the shots there. But I guess if it were me, I'd be on the phone to my local alder person or
the local town, DNR the
local DNR office, and ask to speak to the superintendent, the top person in the office, or go to the regional office and ask for the regional director or supervisor and say, hey, what the heck's going on here? And in the absence of that, You know, if there's a local newspaper there, I'm sure there's somebody on the paper that would find an interesting storyline here to do a little investigative reporting and see what the heck's going on, too. But I can't offer up a rational explanation for that.
And, you know, sometimes the information gets messed up. I used to camp at a lake in northern Wisconsin, and people were complaining that the DNR was netting muskies out of that lake and taking them somewhere else. And so I did just what you just suggested. I called the regional office up there and I told him, I said, "Here, this is what I've been hearing. Is that true?" And he laughed and he said, "No, it's the opposite. We actually are stocking that lake."
Hmm.
With muskie, and so it was just the point is it was the exact opposite.
Right.
And when I went back the next time to camp there, somebody brought that same story up again, and I said, you know what? I called the regional office, and they say that is not true. That they actually, and the person refused to believe me.
Well, there's a long history of, you know, folks trying to or wanting to beat up on the DNR for various environmental, perceived or real environmental issues. And usually they're doing the right thing for the right reasons. But in this case, what he's describing doesn't make any sense. And, you know, maybe they just haven't been able to get the equipment or something. I don't know. But certainly there's somebody who could give Tim a definitive answer.
And I follow up on it, Tim. And then maybe next time Scott's on, let us know what you learned. And if that situation has been resolved. What about you? Question for Scott, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. We got open lines, get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. A listener emailed, and Scott has had a chance to look at this photo. It's of a severed head. This listener found it in their rural Outagamie County yard. The skull was around 5 inches long and almost as wide. And based on the teeth, the snout, and the flat head, they wondered if it wasn't a badger. And then they further asked, would a coyote kill a badger? And then they mentioned they saw their first Oriole on April 23rd, very early. That's out of Gamey County. So,
well,
lots of good stuff
it
there.
Could, you know, the skull's covered with matted hair and whatnot. We can't see much of the teeth, but from the size and the description of the flat structure and all, it does look like a badger skull. But why the sender would have equated that to a coyote issue, I don't know.
No coyote is going to take on a badger.
Badgers are very capable of defending themselves, and any coyote that might have tackled it probably suffered a worse fate than the badger, if that's possible. But, you know, it could have been a roadkill or injury that was scavenged and the skull was transported. There's a lot of things that could have happened, but it does look like a badger skull.
So there we go. And I think we had one more that I wanted to bring up here. And of course, I can't find it right now. Oh, Jeff emailed. He spotted a fisher just west of Eau Claire near the Chippewa River. Fishers, that should not be uncommon, Scott.
No. There are fisher sightings, you know, all the way down here. Pictures from Governor Dodge, from Columbia County. So they could turn up just about anywhere. The stronghold's still in the northern part of the state, but they get around.
And again, we'll take your calls at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. You were going to talk about something else, and I've forgotten what it was now, Scott.
Well, I wanted to offer up a couple of tips.
One thing about gardening,
Yeah, with the gardening season soon to explode, give a little time to thinking about as you're planning a garden or laying it out. Think about heading off some potential wildlife problems with the garden, but also think on the other side as you're selecting shrubs or perennials or ground cover or whatever. Think about as you go to the garden center, purchasing shrubs that produce useful fruits, nuts, berries, and so forth for wildlife, good nesting shelter, plant materials that have beneficial attributes for birds and other wildlife populations. So you can do something on the planting side for wildlife, but you also need to take some steps to protect your plantings from future vole damage during the season. If you're putting a lot of mulch down, deer and rabbits and other things getting into your garden, if you're not putting up an adequate fence to begin with. In other words, just preventative steps pay off in this case. And if you've had problems before with rabbits, you're going to have them again. So take steps to fence now, or you know, do some rabbit removal before the need arises, and you'll be better off in the long run, and so will the wildlife in your neighborhood.
Got Mike in Oak County? I don't know Oak County. It must be another county other than Wisconsin. Mike, are you there?
It's Polk County.
Oh, the Minnesota Polk border. County. Okay.
That I've heard of.
That we know.
We love having birds and squirrels and everybody getting along, but we have one red squirrel that attacks any other bird it sees, chases it away, jumps on it, whereas all the other red squirrels, and we have three others, they just eat quietly, and everybody has his or her own space. Is this a territorial thing, or is there some reason this squirrel is aggressive?
I know one of our callers once said that she observed a squirrel, it was a gray squirrel, eating next to a bird under the bird feeder, and the squirrel jumped on the bird and killed the bird and took it for something.
Took it for dinner.
Yeah.
Well, that does happen. Squirrels, including red squirrels, gray squirrels, and even ground squirrels, can be carnivorous and will take birds, especially fledgling birds, if they have the opportunity. People don't like to think about that, but they do it. It's the way things work. Why that one individual is particularly aggressive, it may be older, it may be a male, the other ones are not. There are a variety of reasons. It could be injured or debilitated in some way, and it takes that out with a little more aggression. But, you know, if that's causing a problem, the squirrels attacking or chasing birds in the first place is a little strange because obviously the others are not. So I guess if it were me, I'd get myself a small but efficient tomahawk live trap and target that particular squirrel and see if you could catch it and just, move it a mile or so away to another woodlot and let your peaceful, peace-loving squirrels get along with the birds and take care of, remove this conflict from your environment. So, I mean, that's another alternative. But in terms of an explanation of why that one squirrel is more aggressive, there are a lot of possible explanations.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Rick in Belleville, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Thanks, Larry. Hi, Scott. So I think, Scott, your take on wildlife being kind of, depending on where you're looking at any given day, is applicable for us down here in Southwest Dane and Primrose. It's kind of rolling and driftless out where we are. So a lot of farmland and woods, but we're seeing a lot of turkeys, at least around my farms. And the other day, walking with some of my pooches, a flock of turkeys running across a tree line, followed behind them by several deer, and then further down the trail, two sandhill cranes kind of making that classic noise that they make, and walking ahead of us, unbelievably, not flying up until really the last minute to get away. But so I think, you know, we're seeing a lot down here. There was one out fanning this morning, and I'm not a turkey hunter, so I have trouble identifying all the different stages of growth, but we're seeing them here, so I thought I'd share that with you.
Yeah, Rick, thank you.
Well, I might have to find out where Rick lives and give him a call, because my grandkids are coming into town. We're trying to find a place to hunt turkeys. But anyway, that's great. I mean, to be able to see a diversity and lots of interesting creatures like that is that's one of the reasons why people live in the country and enjoy Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And since he mentioned the issue of speaking of noise, what he was hearing, I think in the next few days, much like the morels are going to pop, the frogs are really going to come out with a vengeance because they've been suppressed now by this cold weather for quite a long time. So I'm thinking the frog chorus is really going to crank up by early next week. So You know, we've got a dozen species out there. Learn your frog calls so when they start singing, you can identify who you've got in the pond or bird bath or neighboring swamp or creek or whatever, and I think you'll enjoy figuring out who's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Rick, thanks again. Kevin in Black Earth, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
In advance, curious about the bobcat population in the state and the health of that population. Also, I just recently moved between Black Earth and Cross Plains. My neighbor says they've seen bobcat twice in the last week, and my other neighbor says he sees them on his trail cam all the time.
Yeah.
So secondly, I want to know if I should be worried about my outdoor cats, and I'll hang up and listen offline. Thank you very much.
Okay, two issues, Kevin. Number one, bobcats in the last decade have really, well, I shouldn't say exploded, but they've become far more common in the Driftless area, kind of moving down the western half of the state from what was their stronghold in north central and northern Wisconsin. So when I moved here, well, 50 years ago now, a bobcat out in southwestern Wisconsin was virtually unheard of. You know, few people would say, I heard one, I saw one. It was a cause for some interest. Now they've become commonplace. So anywhere in the Driftless area, including where you are, I'm not at all surprised that they're turning up regularly on trail cameras or that people are seeing them. The second part of the question, whether you should be concerned about your outdoor cats, that's a tough one for me to deal with.
May be on a farm.
You know, if the cats are out roaming around, they're probably bigger threats in the form of coyotes and, depending on where you're further north, with fishers and whatnot. There are a number of animals that will take free-ranging cats. And I suppose a bobcat will if it gets the opportunity. But I think the bobcats are generally a little more secretive and reclusive than coyotes and some of the other things you might have to worry about with your cats. So, how should I conclude this? Yes, it might be a source of some concern, but the reality is there are lots of fates that can befall an outdoor cat, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. And just a reminder that hawks, if you've got hawks coming into your by your feeders, that is a time to be taking down your feeders for at least for the moment. Or if you have flocks of chickens, just a small flock even, you probably don't want to have your feeder up and running at least for a while till we hear otherwise. And on that note, Scott, we're out of time. You'll be back on June 1st.
Yes, very quickly, actually. Probably one of the quickest turnarounds in my long involvement with public radio. So, yes, I'll be back. We're headed up north to do our summer field camp for our wildlife ecology students next week. And I'll be up there for that all month. And then I can talk about that when we get back. Life in the North Woods.
Oh, that sounds great. Thank you, Scott. Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist with UW Extension. Great to have him back. Tomorrow, we talk with an expert about the classic Wisconsin card games of euchre, sheep's head, and cribbage. Do you play them all? I've played every one of those games. We'll also look at the history of seven games that are popular around the world. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. But in the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.